Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Carl Hiaasen writes a regular column for the Miami Herald and is the author of many best-selling novels, including Star Island and Bad Monkey for adults, and Hoot, Chomp, Scat, and Flush for young readers. His latest, Skink No Surrender, is his first novel for teens. In the book, one of Hiaasen's most beloved characters, Skink, the one-eyed, roadkill-eating ex-governor of Florida, returns to the page. The new novel is Skink, No Surrender, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Carl Hiaasen to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. Always nice to speak with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
Thank you very much for being here. This character, Skink, this is his what number appearance in your work?
I don't know, Joe. I think he was in six of the adult novels or the grown-up novels, I believe. But I have not counted them up. I'll be honest with you. I don't know. I sort of drop him in into certain stories where I think he fits and where he, you know, I need a certain kind of vengeance or misbehavior and let him go. But I haven't kept track.
Don't you always need vengeance in some way?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is all therapy, really. I mean, if any writer were honest with you.
It's fascinating to me because this is such a wonderful character, and we'll talk about Skink specifically in a moment. But as you just said, the story takes over, and then you decide that you want to bring this character in. I mentioned in the introduction that this is your first novel for teens. I assume you don't sit down and say, this is going to be my first novel for teens. You write a novel, and it sort of just fits that criteria.
Yeah, I alternate books, you know, for grown-ups and for young readers, but I don't think about age categories at all. You're right. I had a story in my head and I thought it was time after all these years to sort of, I thought it was safe to unleash this character Skink, you know, in the youth of America finally. But I didn't have a particular age group in mind. That the story evolved in a way that it deals with a boy whose cousin has run off with a fellow she's met on the online who is not who he claims to be. The boy in the book has to go find the cousin. And because of that subject matter and the danger inherent in that kind of behavior, that they decided and I agreed that it was probably aimed at a little bit older readers than like Hoot and Flush.
Richard is a really cool kid. He's a nice kid with a very strong moral compass.
Yeah, I like him. I liked him from the first page. It's not always true with your characters. You never know. And he is very protective of his cousin, who is sort of a wild child and rebellious and has had some issues at home. And she's run away before, so at first there's not a level of concern that she's gone again. But Richard is a kid that has, you know, like you said, not just a good moral compass, but a good instinct. And his instinct was that this was something bad had happened, and he wanted to find her and save her. So that's how he ends up in the car with this crazy one-eyed ex-governor, you know, speeding across the state of Florida.
He seems very accepting of situations and certainly of this person that most of us should be frightened of, perhaps with good reason. And yet he's accepting. He looks him up on Wikipedia, he finds out mm-hmm. about him and says, all right, he is who he is and accepts that.
Yeah, because he's smart. He's not going to get into the car without, you know, with anybody. But he meets him on the beach under some unusual circumstances, and he gets his name out of him, his real name, which is Clinton Tyree, and he looks it up online, and he finds out that this figure and there's photographs, so he knows who he's dealing with. But he has sort of this mythical phantom in Florida, a guy who disappeared from Tallahassee in the middle of his term as governor. Kind of everyone said he went nuts. And, you know, he's seen here, he's seen there, but nobody knows where he really is. And Richard realizes it's the real deal. And you're right, a lot of kids would be scared. But he gets a sense that this is another individual with a strong moral compass, and that, if nothing else about Skink is true, that if he believes in the right things, the way he goes after and protects his beliefs and carries them out is something else again.
I think in anyone else's hands, a character like this, a one-eyed former governor from Florida who likes roadkill and found under the sand, would become a caricature. But this is a very believable character. This is a very believable Floridian. What do you think it is about a character like this that is adaptable in your stories and also is something that you can put into the equation and have be accepted?
That's a good question, Joe, because this character is sort of, you know, originally he appeared in a novel many, many years ago called Double Whammy back in 1987, and it was good. He was just going to be a walk-on and a hermit guy. And then I gave him this backstory as a former governor, and he just came to life on the page, and he started saying and doing these things that I found not just entertaining but a little bit inspiring. And so I kept him around in that book, and he was just one of these characters I couldn't put to rest. And I think he's authentic to me, and I think a lot of it is what he says. It's not his behavior can be erratic and sometimes pushing the envelope, but it's when he speaks and when he talks to people about what's important in the world and what's important to him that I think he comes out as a real person and a genuine person. And I think kids in particular as readers are quite sophisticated. They don't expect their heroes to be perfect. And this is not a perfect person, but he has heroic qualities despite everything else. And I think that's what connects him with both the young readers and the older ones.
The fact that he is this former governor and he has this backstory that Richard finds out about, there isn't just, of course, there's the erratic behavior, but Richard trusts this guy. He is willing to trust him. And Richard, as you said earlier, seems very, very sensible, but knows who to trust and perhaps who not to trust. There is a good instinct there.
Yeah, there is, and this is a kid who's lost his father, and his father died in an accident.
Bizarre accident,
and his mom is now remarried, and so he's had to make big adjustments, and his world is much different than it was when he was a little boy. And so part of it's trust, and part of it's the wisdom to sort of recognize people for what they are, and he gets along great with his stepdad, but he also knows that it's not the same as his real dad. And Skink he approaches somewhat warily, but the thing that came shining through with his character and has in all the novels is that if he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. And he may leave wreckage in his wake, but it'll get done. And when he says to Richard, we're going to go find your cousin, we're going to go find Mally, you know that it's going to happen one way or another. And Richard gets overpowered by that feeling. Now, that being said, here he is in a car in the middle of the night racing down this highway, and Skink is slowing down and having him scoop up, you know, possums and armadillos that have been killed on the road and throw them in the back seat of the car. So Richard is adjusting again to that kind of a companion, a partner.
The other thing I loved about the book is that it's so much about the many facets of Florida. I mean, Richard is a kid, I guess, from a beach town, and all of the characters that come, and you're so close to the beauty of the ocean, and then yet, as you're staring at the ocean behind you, is just the nuttiness that is Florida.
Yeah, the craziness. You know, the book opens and Skink is on the beach in the first place because he's been pursuing on foot for literally hundreds of miles a guy who's stealing turtle eggs from the nests on the beach and selling them on the black market, which is a real problem in Florida. It's not something I made up. These creeps exist, and they dig up the nests and they run off and they sell to these exotic markets where, you know, for sea turtle eggs. So that's Skink's current pursuit, but that, again, I didn't make that up. We have those kinds of criminals, and in the hand, and Skink, and his intent is not to turn him over to the authorities. We'll leave it at that. His intent is to deal with him in another way. So, and then you go right from this beach scene to now they're on the highway, and now they've got some clues to where the cousin is, and their next thing you know, they're on this river in North Florida. It just shows you the variety, the wonderful variety of Florida. They're on a river, and the rest of the book is you know, it's part Huck Finn, part Deliverance. I mean, it's a chase, and it's scary, and it's funny, and it's all of that. But it's a completely different setting than what Richard is used to. He's a beach kid. He skateboards. His brothers are surfers, and all of a sudden, he's in true wilderness.
Were you a beach kid?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Lauderdale. I grew up west of the city, but I mean, we did our pilgrimage to the beach, and I spend obviously a lot of time on the water down there. I mean, I can't say it's beach, but I'm on the water a lot, in boats and fishing and that kind of stuff. But the beach thing, yeah, when you, especially in the teenage years, remember when I was growing up in Lauderdale, that was where spring break originated.
Right.
So the highlight of your year as a high school kid was to go down to the Los Olas when spring break was taking place, because you got to see college girls in bikinis. I mean, when you're a teenage boy, that's what you lived for. And now spring break has evolved into something way, way beyond that. But when I was a kid, that's about how innocent it was. Let's go down there and scope out the, you know. I mean, you know, you're a typical sort of brainless teenager. That's what you did.
And yet when you write teenagers, they aren't brainless.
No, they're much smarter than I was when I was an age, I got to tell you that. Because I think they are in real life, Joe. I mean, I think the level of sophistication, let's talk about the environmental issues. The kids today are much more aware of that the air should be cleaner, the water should be cleaner, the people are dumb, you know, the pollution and how it gets there, and even the politics of pollution, the political pressures that go into allowing a place to be destroyed. They understand it way better than I did when I was a kid. I just got mad about it. I would just get mad when developers would come in and bulldoze, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres of a wild place. The kids today make an effort to find out why. What's the company? And now they go online and they can find out the whole scenario of how it happened. And they do that. And that's the kind of kid Richard is, and to some extent Mally, his cousin. They're much, much smarter than I was.
I like Richard because his stepfather, who, as you say, he gets along with okay, but his stepfather is petrified of nature. I think you say in the book that if you were to hit a golf ball into the woods, he wouldn't go in after it because he'd be so scared of what was on the other side.
Yeah, his idea of wilderness was like a putting green on the 18th hole right next to the clubhouse.
but Richard sort of helps him through that in understanding nature and is teaching the adult.
Yeah, absolutely. And we learn a lot from kids. I mean, if you have kids and grandkids and you're around them for any length of time and they're friends, if you're around their friends as well, the best thing you can do is to just kind of be quiet and listen to them talk and listen what they're interested in and how they're getting their information. And you can learn a lot. And if you're a writer, that's what you have to do anyway. If you want to recreate authentic dialogue between two 13 or 14-year-old kids, you've got to shut up and listen to them talk. And it's funny and they're smart. And I mean, it's enlightening in a lot of ways. It's a fun part of the job.
You mentioned the environmental issues in the books, and this has been a hallmark of yours and certainly has been something that has been a part of the novels and is in this one. How do you incorporate that and again, I would assume consciously make it a part of it on several levels? I mean, there's a part in this book about the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yes.
Of how you're going to make that part of the story and say what you want to say about it.
Well, in this case, yeah. I mean, I don't have any agendas and I don't have a master plan when I write these books. But I do know that because the only place I really know is Florida, and the places I know best are the wild places and the outdoor places. I'm not a city person, and I don't think I could sit down and write a gritty urban Miami novel. And truth is, I don't want to. If I can set a novel in the Everglades, I'm much more comfortable there. In this case, I did want to write about this. I've been reading about this incredible bird, the ivory-billed woodpecker, which is most people think is extinct now for many, many years, but that there are some pockets of places in Florida, and that's where Richard ends up eventually with Skink, on a river where there had been alleged sightings. And I like the idea of believing in something. You know, in Richard's case, he's sort of a science-minded kid, and he's done the research, and he says, you know, the birds are great. We did a project on them in school, but they don't exist anymore. They're gone. We wiped them out. And Skink, as cynical and tough as he is on the outside, inside he's a dreamer, and he believes they're still there. And he believes, and he has them looking up in the trees wherever they go. He says, keep your eyes out for them. And it's kind of a nice juxtaposition in my mind. I just wanted that scene and that feel because there's been so many times, and I went up on that river and took a trip myself while I was working on the book, and I found myself looking in the treetops, hoping against hope to see one of those. They're just incredible looking birds, you know, and the only ones I ever saw were in the Smithsonian in a drawer. So I was kind of hoping for the real thing too, but I like the idea that the old guy, the crusty, tough old guy, is the guy that has this improbable dream, and that Richard appreciates that and learns from that as well.
Carl Hiaasen is our guest on the book show this week. The book is Skink, No Surrender, and it's published by Knopf. When you started writing novels, what did you want it to accomplish that your column did not?
I did it. I started writing novels because, at the time I started writing Tourist Season, for example, I did three sort of thrillers with another reporter at the Herald, and that was just to see if I could do it. And also, I liked working with them, but they were much different kinds of books, Joe. But when I started on Tourist Season, I was still on the investigations team at the Herald, and by the time, and I was writing at night. We were working on big projects where I didn't have to do a lot of writing during the day, and I had a lot of energy to burn because I wasn't writing daily, and you know. So I was working on Tourist Season, and just coincidentally, an editor asked me as soon as we finished up that investigation, if I wanted to start the column. And the novels, I mean, part of it was a creative muscle that I wanted to see if I had and I could exercise. And part of it was, as I mentioned to you early, truly a kind of therapy. There's the trouble with writing for a newspaper is that you don't get to write your own endings, and you end up covering a lot of stories where there is not a happy ending, and you've got to report it anyway. And the selfish and also lovely thing about novels is that the characters belong to you, the story belongs to you, and if you want it to end a certain way, that's your choice. And my choice was to have it end, have all my novels end in a much more satisfying way than similar stories ended in real life.
In writing the types of books that you do, and this could be said for the books that you write for young adults or for adults, and that is that there's great humor, and there is also I think it's safe to say a sarcasm and a cynicism toward the people of Florida, but there has to be a sense of love and pride there too, doesn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, I care about the place tremendously. I care about the people who live there. The political leadership is pathetic, and they have been. And I mean, they give me great material for the columns, selfishly, but they also give me great targets for satirical novels. I mean, and those kinds of characters, whether it's a lobbyist, whether it's a politician, a city councilman, whatever it is, they're not that exaggerated in the books. Trust me, they're not too far off the real deal that I've dealt with and written about over the years. But you can be mad about what's happening in politics and what's happening to a place you care about and still obviously love the place very much. And this is one way of, I mean, I don't want to say it's crusading because it's not, but it sort of keeps you going as long as you got the burn of anger. A lot of very, very funny writers write from a very dark place, a sense of anger and some injustice. And, you know, when you're making fun of something, which is what satire is all about, there's a much sharper edge to it. It's not slapstick. I want the books to be funny. I like nothing better than to see somebody sitting in an airport reading one of my books and laughing. That's kind of the deal. But at the same time, I want them to be laughing for the right reason. I want them to get it, to get the joke and get what's behind the joke. And that's the best thing about my sketchy fan bases. They get it. They dig it. They know where I'm coming from.
So do the people who get it, do they get it, do you think, when they're reading the newspaper, in the sense of what the politicians are made of what, as you call them, the creeps, the people that would go into a nursing home to steal the medication to sell it, or whatever the
case
may
be? That was based on a real guy, by the way. That guy, the guy that was stealing the fentanyl patches in that book, that was real. I ripped that out of the newspaper, too. I think Floridians see the books as documentaries, and I think the rest of the country sort of sees this, often sees them as satire. But, the weird thing about Florida is everywhere you go, every state you're in on a book tour, wherever you're there's always you're talking to an audience, and almost everybody has a Florida connection, an aunt, a grandmother, a vacation. I mean, it's just incredible. Right. Everybody has a Florida story when they come up to ask you to sign their book. They tell you something about Florida. So I think they get it. I think they also sort of understand the magnetism of this place, as trampled as it is right now. We have 19 million people in Florida right now. I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of it has a very strong appeal. And people have in their heads sort of a postcard ideal of what this place is. So that's the only thing that, to me, accounts for the fact that the books sell north of Tallahassee.
And they're not regional, because people understand. But also people understand nutty politics and people who are not above board.
Right. There's corruption everywhere, and there's odd behavior everywhere, and there's all kinds of scams being worked everywhere. But the sheer concentration and volume and variety and the reliability that you feel in Florida, that when you pick up a paper on any given day, there's going to be a story on the front page or maybe page two that you could really truly spin into its own novel. The level of the sheer volume of weirdness, I think, surpasses Southern California and almost Arizona. I think it's weirder than Arizona some days. And that's saying something.
And yet you never want to leave. You never want to go somewhere else.
Where would I go? I mean, honestly, what would I do? Like I said, I have strong roots there. My family and, you know, my mom is still there, and my kids, my grandkids are there. I mean, you just can't. I always compare it to, like, abandoning a dying relative at bedside. I mean, you're sneaking out the back door. You know, so somebody's got to stay and fight and say things that a lot of people wish they could say, and have their characters get away with things that a lot of people wish they could get away with. And I think that's been the attraction of this character of Skink in particular, is that he goes off and does things that a lot of people are cheering for.
There's a section about midway through the book where Richard and Skink are talking, and Richard asks, tell me the heaviest thing that you've ever done in your life, and I'll tell you what I did. And Richard says, I wasn't ready for what he said. My jaw hung open while Skink told his story. The craziest rumors about him on Wikipedia didn't come close to what he told me that night. I'd write it in these pages, except I promised him I'd never tell a soul. Do you see yourself going back to this character and filling in some of those blanks?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the readers, the grown-up readers who had read the other novels would remember things that that Skink probably would not tell this young man that he had done. I think that Skink has a sense for this is what might be appropriate to share, and also that he knows he's not a role model. He'll be the first one to say it. But those dark secrets, I don't know. I don't think it's bad when a character has secrets, and I don't think as a writer you're compelled to tell readers everything about a character. I think that it doesn't happen in real life. And I think, if nothing else, I try to make my books, even though they're satiric, at least in the way that the characters feel about each other, I try to get as close to real life and real feelings as I can. That's how readers connect. There's a great deal of affection that Richard feels towards this very shaky figure who's taking him on this mission. But the fact that he would drop everything and say, let's go find your cousin, because he knows that she's in trouble too. I mean, not everyone would do that. And so that's where the bond comes from.
And given that Hoot came out several years ago, so the kids that read that book, they're grown up now.
It's scary. Yeah, I see them. I see them in the bookstores, and they're like out of college, some of them, and they're buying the grown-up books, which always shakes me up a little bit. But I never even thought of that. I never thought that they'd hang with you. But that's the one thing about young readers, Joe, that one of the great things that surprised me was their incredible loyalty. They stay with you through every single book. And then once they're old enough to read the grown-up books, they're doing that. And they stand in line and they tell me, you signed a copy of Hoot for me 12 years ago. And I do feel like Methuselah when they say those things. And I'm looking at a grown person instead of a little kid standing there with his book. But it's also a cool feeling that they're so loyal and that they sort of hung with you through a lot of different kinds of writing.
Well, I love the new book. I love the novel. It's Skink, No Surrender. It's published by Knopf. Carl, it's always a blast to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks,
out.
Joe. Thanks for, as I said, having me back again. You're very brave.
Always, always a pleasure. Thank you very much. Carl Hiaasen's new novel is Skink, No Surrender. It's published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.